Good evening. Welcome to Behind the News for January 4, 2007. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. First show of the new year. And let's hope this year is somewhat better than last. Not that that last was the worst in history, but let's just hope for improvement, constant improvement. And I've got two interviews up for tonight. First, in a minute or so, we'll be listening to an interview I recorded a couple of weeks ago with Gilbert Achkar, the Lebanese-born political scientist and writer, talking about the Middle East and the U.S. and Israeli projects there and the defeats those two countries have suffered in Iraq and in Lebanon. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll be joined in the studio by Charles Komenoff, who is an energy economist who will be speaking in Manhattan this evening. And I'll give the details on that at the bottom of the hour, just before Charlie comes on. But he will be speaking at 7 o'clock tonight about carbon taxes, which is seems like an appropriate topic. It is, what, 55 degrees, and it is the 4th of January. This is, kind of comfy. It is scary and apocalyptic, and so we need to do something about the emissions of greenhouse gases. And Charles Komenoff has a plan, carbon taxes, and we'll talk to him about that at the bottom of the hour. So since this is about a 28-minute interview and I'd like to squeeze into the first half hour, let's get right to it. This is an interview I recorded a couple of weeks ago with Gilbert Achkar, who is originally from Lebanon, now teaches at the University of Paris, author most recently of The Clash of Barbarisms, published by Monthly Review Press, and co-author with Noam Chomsky of Perilous Power, The Middle East and U.S. Foreign Policy, which came out from Paradigm Publishers last September. He's a frequent contributor to Le Monde Diplomatique, and his writings can be found on the web at ZNet and on Juan Cole's blog, Informed Comment. I recorded this interview several weeks ago, but I don't think there are any anachronisms lurking in it. Gilbert Achkar.
It looks like the U.S. imperial project has suffered a series of defeats in the Middle East, first directly in Iraq and then indirectly in Lebanon. Do you agree with that assessment?
Of course. I mean, it's absolutely clear that the U.S. imperial project, just put it, is in nowadays, and the main illustration of that is, I could say, that the boldness shown by Iran in its attitude on various issues facing the United States. That's one of the results of this apparent weakness and failure in which Washington has found itself. Of course, it started mainly with Iraq and the accumulation of all sorts of difficulties in Iraq for Washington. And then this had repercussions elsewhere. And of course, what happened in Lebanon this summer and the results of that, which were not at all what Washington and Israel had expected, just aggravated the whole picture. And it is indeed a picture of failure, and that's why you have this whole disarray in the U.S. establishment, especially the foreign policy establishment and the U.S. ruling class, big disarray about what to do, how are we going to get out of the situation, forming all sorts of commissions to investigate and make proposals. The overall picture is, I think, quite clear.
I was having a disagreement with a friend of mine last night. I said that I thought that Israel had suffered a defeat in Lebanon. He thought it was more ambiguous than that. How do you grade it? Was it a defeat or is it ambiguous?
Oh, that was very clearly a defeat when measured against the targets, the goals. I mean, one can list the goals and just compare the goals to what was achieved. I mean, if we start even from the very basic one, which was, one could consider as a pretext, but that was the official goal, the soldiers that were abducted by Hezbollah, well, they are still in the hands of Hezbollah. But then if you move to the real goals, the real targets of this offensive, which was planned much longer before the abduction or anything of the kind. That was something which was prepared for a long time. And, the main target was, one, to deal Hezbollah a very heavy blow, to weaken the organization militarily, organizationally, structurally, to try even to assassinate its leader, Nasrallah. Two, to create such a difficult situation for the Shia community, so that Hezbollah get isolated within its own community, within its own religious community, I mean its main constituency, and be held responsible for the dramatic situation in which the people would find themselves. And three, take the whole of Lebanon as a hostage, create a kind of pressure and political conditions through which the Lebanese government, which is dominated by partners of Washington, would find itself in a position to enter the arena and exert its own pressure attempt at disarming Hezbollah, which is the official demand of Washington through the United Nations. So if you measure the results of the offensive of this summer against all these goals and targets, I mean, it's a blatant failure. It was a total fiasco, and I think there is a kind of unanimity in Israel itself, except for Olmert, except for the government, to acknowledge that. I mean, if one reads, if one has read the Israeli press, at least what is translated in English, this summer after the war, I mean, there was a lot of bitterness about what was perceived, and rightly so, as a failure.
The government in Lebanon, Washington's ally there, is looking very weak and possibly terminal. What is your reading of the current Lebanese political situation?
Terminal is difficult to say because, I mean, this is a country divided in two blocks. And, I mean, it's quite difficult, if not impossible, for any of the two blocks to prevail completely over the other. That's why, actually, the country actually stands at a crossroad between a compromise between the two blocks or civil war. I mean, that's what we are at. To believe that this kind of mass movement could topple the government and change the government is completely wrong, because that's not the kind of situation you're in. You are in a country really divided, and where there can't be a winner except through a terrible war. I mean, but the country has already had its an overdose of civil war for 15 years, and one can only hope that the situation doesn't slip again towards such a situation of civil conflict. So the opposition now, which is mobilizing in the streets, led by Hezbollah and the allies of Hezbollah, various allies, including one of the major Christian forces in Lebanon, the one led by General Aoun, the opposition is not actually demanding, for instance, a resignation or whatever of the government. It's not trying to topple the government for the time being, although they threaten that they would do so if their demands are not satisfied. But for the time being, they are asking for the government to be enlarged with more ministers from the opposition included in the government, so as to get one third of the government and a kind of minority bloc which could exert a veto right on governmental decision. That's what the opposition is asking for. And it is by itself a demand pointing to a compromise, that is, to a kind of government, a paritary government, a government of both forces, of both blocs, which would have then to govern the country on the basis of a consensus.
Would that be possible? Would that be incorporating too many contradictions into the government?
Well, that would be possible if Washington would not be interfering. I mean, that would be possible then, in the sense that that's the only way out. There's no possibility to rule that country, Lebanon, except through compromises. I mean, if you are an external observer or whatever, you could, or a critical observer, you could consider all these compromises as quite rotten, as the whole political system in Lebanon is quite rotten. I mean, it's a kind of sectarian system based on all kinds of privileges, corruption, and all the rest. But that's the way it is, at least for the time being. And, I mean, except by some wild dream, one can't see how it could change thoroughly in the near future. And therefore, it can only function on the basis of compromises. Now, the problem is that Washington is pushing behind in Lebanon, and the same goes for Palestine, in the direction of civil war. I mean, the Washington strategy is actually in both societies where there are forces which are held in Washington as main enemies, as allies of the main enemy, which is Tehran, which is Iran, and these forces are Hamas in Palestine and the Hezbollah in Lebanon. Well, in both societies, Washington is pushing the partners, that is the Senora government, the Hariri bloc, and its allies in Lebanon, or the Palestinian Authority led by Mahmoud Abbas in Palestine, to clash with the enemy. That is, Washington is pushing for civil war among the Palestinians and among the Lebanese, and that's absolutely terribly dangerous for the societies concerned. And here again, Washington is playing with fire. I mean, this administration is playing with fire. It has already created nightmarish, dramatic situation in Iraq. And, I mean, if this administration were left to act as it wishes, we would have other Iraqs over the Middle East. And, I mean, one can't see where would be the bottom of this tragedy.
I'm speaking with Gilbert Achkar, the Lebanese-born political scientist and author who now teaches at the University of Paris.
Hezbollah achieved an iconic status throughout the region for having kicked Israel out of Lebanon. But what is your understanding of it as an organization? Is it a fundamentalist theocratic organization, or is it more flexible than that?
It's an Islamic fundamentalism adapted to Lebanese reality. That's a very peculiar condition. That is, originally, this organization is a Khomeinist organization. That is, it's based on the ideological premises of Khomeinism, of the ruling ideology of the Iranian state. And it's closely linked, as everyone knows, to Tehran, to the Iranian state. So it believes in the basic tenets of this Islamic fundamentalism that is characteristic of Iran and of the revolution led by Ayatollah Khomeini. But since the beginning, I mean, Hezbollah had to acknowledge the fact that Lebanon is a country with peculiarities where you can't apply or aim at applying the kind of regime that, you have in Iran, because it's a multi-religious country where not only there are non-Muslims, and there are, I mean, a major section of the population, the Christians, but even Muslims themselves are not all Shias, and there's an important Sunni section. Of course, I mean, the Shia could be considered as the largest minority in Lebanon, but just the largest minority, no more than that. And so this was acknowledged from the beginning in the conception that, well, the Hezbollah believes in the basic tenets of the Khomeinist ideology, but doesn't consider that it can put that into practice at the level of the state in Lebanon, and therefore would have to content itself with a more modest ambition, which is control over its community. And that's what Hezbollah is basically interested in, that is, its control over the Shia community, where it has achieved a certain degree of hegemony. It's not the only force. There is another important force in the Shiite community, which is Amal, and which is in alliance with Hezbollah. But still, I mean, Hezbollah is obviously the most popular and by far the strongest among the Shia community in Lebanon. And for the rest of that, they use this position of power in their community to enter into various deals with the other forces, and more so because since they have entered more directly the political fray, that is, after the withdrawal of Syrian troops in Lebanon, they got into an alliance with the Hariri, with Washington's partners, actually, for the election, the parliamentary election in 2005, and that's how they ended up being in the government for the first time. But that was a government dominated by Washington's partners. I mean, this is very paradoxical, but that's how it is. So this is an organization which has an Islamic fundamentalist program and roots, but which in its actual behavior in Lebanon adapted very much to the Lebanese situation. And that's, I mean, the reality of Hezbollah.
Let's turn now to a miserable story, Iraq. The United States seems to be in a serious bind there. The United States, it looks like the United States cannot win, but it cannot afford to withdraw, given the importance it's given not only to Iraq, but to control of the Middle East. What do you think the U.S.'s options really are at this point, and are they stuck?
Well, I think you characterize the situation quite well. That's exactly that. That is, they cannot win. It has now become obvious that, first of all, victory, as it was defined by the Bush administration in the first years of the occupation, is something now beyond even imagination. And one can't see any practical way through which they could end up this mess there by claiming again mission accomplished. I mean, unless they would be fooling themselves or fooling the rest, trying to fool the rest of the world. And on the other hand, they can't afford to just acknowledge defeat and get out because of what is at stake. And as Kissinger and Schultz have written a couple of years ago, a defeat in Iraq would be much more important strategically than whatever Vietnam meant for the United States. Because, I mean, on the one hand, what is at stake in Iraq is much more important because of, I mean, everyone understands the importance of the area, the strategic importance of the area and of Iraq itself as one of the major oil reserves in the world. But also the impact of a defeat of Washington in Iraq would affect what Kissinger and Schultz described, and I mean in the kind of vocabulary they use in the establishment, as you know, the credibility of the U.S. deterrence, of U.S. power, of the U.S. imperial power, and to be affected with a second defeat on the scale of Vietnam in that regard would be absolutely a terrible blow for the whole imperial project. So that's the dilemma they are facing. And that's why you have all these think tanks and special committees or groups or study groups or whatever, which are being formed trying to devise some way out of this quagmire, which might look as, a face-saving solution and at the same time saving the essential, that is the interest, that is U.S. control over Iraq on the one hand, the area on the other hand. But to put it frankly, I can't see any possible way through which this could be achieved. That is, the longer U.S. forces will stay in Iraq, the more this country will be, affected by this dramatic, nightmarish situation, the more this country will be slipping towards civil war, as it is, it has already. Now the discussion is less and less about whether it is or not a civil war, but to what kind of civil war it is. I mean, that's what is being discussed now. And actually, it could turn even worse than what it is already now. And I keep saying it's nightmarish, but that's exactly that. I mean, those who live there are living through absolutely awful, an awful experience.
What's your theory of why the United States invaded Iraq in the first place? In retrospect, it looks like the most self-damaging thing the United States has ever done since it became an imperial power. But why did they do it in the first place?
You had a bipartisan consensus, a very obvious one. Since the early 19th, since the first U.S. war against Iraq, on the necessity for the U.S., from the point of view of the U.S. ruling class, the necessity of exerting control over Iraq. And actually, that's the reason why they didn't topple Saddam Hussein in 91 is precisely that at that time they had no alternative, nothing ready that could replace Saddam Hussein and be a docile tool of the United States. And therefore, instead of overthrowing him and getting an internal situation in Iraq which could move in ways that could be deemed, very dangerous or hostile for the United States, they prefer to keep Saddam Hussein in power until they have the conditions to overthrow him. So during the whole period of this genocidal embargo that they imposed on Iraq, which actually affected much more the Iraqi population than it affected Saddam Hussein. It did not affect Saddam Hussein at all. Well, during all these years, they tried several ways, you know, of managing, organizing some kind of coup that would bring to power forces connected to the United States, either through Shalabi or what they tried, or through Allawi and connections within the army and all that. But, I mean, they didn't have anything credible during this whole period. And then you had 9/11, which gave the Bush administration the political conditions and the kind of ideological legitimation that was needed in order to occupy the country, which was not possible in 91 for Bush Senior. For Bush, under Bush Junior, and that was not even possible for, of course, under Clinton in 98, he was not in a political position to do that when there was there were some, let's say, available pretext for a military action of this scale. So this happened after 9/11, exploiting 9/11 in the most cynical way, because every person with a minimum of knowledge knows that there's no connection between 9/11 and Saddam Hussein and Iraq. And that, I mean, a lot of people have said before the invasion happens that, I mean, the best service that could be rendered to Al-Qaeda would be that the United States occupy Iraq. And that's exactly what happened. And now Al-Qaeda can boast of having a real foothold in the heart of the Arab Middle East. I mean, in Iraq, there's areas of Iraq which are under control of Al Qaeda, and that's, I mean, one of the clearest signs of the failure. So they agreed on the goal, on the target. But now the problem is the way the Bush administration managed the operation, the way the Bush administration tried to lay its hand over Iraq, is the thing that was completely failure. And I mean by that, this neoconservative blueprint and illusions they had about the fact that they would be greeted, you know, in Iraq, and they would be able to find in Iraq a constituency for some kind of pseudo-democratic government that would be closely controlled by Washington, in a kind of stabilized situation. But that was completely crazy to believe for 1 minute in such a scheme. Of course, had they been more intelligent, shrewder people, less believing in this self-delusions propagated by the neoconservatives, had they been so more realistic from that point of view, they could have acted in a different way. They could have cut a deal with a section of the apparatus in Iraq of the Saddamist state and get rid of Saddam Hussein and, you know, try to have a friendly government in the country, but that would be still continuing the kind of dictatorship that you had. Of course, it doesn't mean that this kind of blueprint could have succeeded, because the odds that the country would have exploded in any case, and that you would have seen a collapse of the whole state structure, because, I mean, that was such a centralized dictatorship for such a long period of several decades that whenever you have some crack in the whole system, it usually collapses quite rapidly. But at least, I mean, that would have been more clever, I mean, as a kind of strategy from the point of view, of course, of the U.S. ruling class, from the point of view of the U.S. establishment. But this administration opted for the dumbest, the most stupid kind of strategy, and it was a total failure. I mean, so from the very first months in 2003, it was already clear that they were getting stuck into a terrible nightmare. And many of us, I mean, I'm one of many people who have said before the invasion, and several months before the invasion, before March 2003, that you will get that kind of outcome. Although I should say that even the most pessimistic, and I was one of them, were not imagining that it would get, I mean, to that point, I mean, this kind of awful situation where you have people committing suicide to kill hundreds of, or tens or hundreds of other people belonging to the same people, I mean, just because of sectarian divisions. I mean, this is absolutely awful.
I'm speaking with Gilbert Achkar, the Lebanese-born political scientist and author who now teaches at the University of Paris.
Finally, with the U.S. And its Israeli ally suffering such terrible blows to their power and prestige, what do you see the broader repercussions in the region will be? For example, is the Saudi regime more vulnerable now?
Yeah, well, the only defense that they've got is to use sectarianism. That's what they are doing. That's what the Saudis are doing, to block Iranian influence by resorting to sectarianism. Sunnis versus Shias. And that's why, actually, there's this ambiguous relation with the so-called insurgency in Iraq. The armed groups that are active among the Sunnis in Iraq, they are de facto, linked to the Wahhabis in the Saudi kingdom. And that's why they shifted in the last year from a major focus on the United States into to a major focus on Iran and the Shias. And their language now is that the main enemy in Iraq is Iran and the Shias, and that's the main battle. Of course, among the Shia forces also, there's the development of sectarian views and the sectarian behavior and the retaliations, and all that has produced a very, very, very dangerous dynamics. But that's the only defense that the Saudi kingdom and Washington behind it have found to try to block Iranian influence. They try to discredit Hezbollah in Lebanon on the same ground, that these are Shias. And in Lebanon, they have exploited the sectarian division in a very dangerous way, to the point that now, in Lebanon, the sectarian conflict that looms the horizon is not between Christians and Muslims, as it has been during the 15-year civil war, but it's between Sunni and Shias. That's where the sectarian tension is at its sharpest.
It sounds like the risk then is we could generalize the conditions of Iraq across the entire region.
In a sense, one could say, fortunately, in the entire region, you don't have various sects, in the sense that the Shias are present in Lebanon. They are in Iraq, of course, where they are the majority, almost two-thirds of the population. They are in Bahrain. They are on the eastern coast of the Saudi kingdom. But you don't have them in Egypt, for instance, or in Jordan or Palestine or other areas. And that's where we find the limits of this kind of policy. That is, where you have a coexistence of the two sects or the two communities, this exploitation of sectarianism is successful in a very dangerous manner, as we are seeing. But in other countries, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. And this propaganda that Shia against the Shia and Iran doesn't really work and is countered in an efficient manner by the Iranians, who against that are holding the banner of Islam and outbidding the Saudis and the rest in some, let's say, of the popular issues in the Middle East, including the most dumb and stupid way, this Holocaust conference. I'm referring to that. That is the fact that Iran is playing on such issues is by itself actually not directed against Israel or the Jews or whatever. The main target of all that is the Saudi kingdom, is the fact that they want to prevent the Saudis from presenting Iran, as Shia, and pose themselves as the holders of the banner of Islamic radicalism, Islamic fundamentalism, against not only the United States, but Israel and the rest. If you look at the public opinion in most Arab countries, those who are not confronted with the sectarian issue because the overwhelming majority is Sunni, well, in those cases, actually, Iran, Hezbollah, and allies of Iran and Hezbollah, of course, Hamas included, but Hamas is a Sunni organization, are much more popular, of course, than Washington's friends.
And that's the voice of Gilbert Achkar, who is a Lebanese-born political writer and analyst who now teaches the University of Paris. His most recent books are The Clash of Barbarisms from Monthly Review Press and Perilous Power, The Middle East and U.S. Foreign Policy, co-written with Noam Chomsky, out from Paradigm Publishers. Let's take a little musical break, and we'll be back.
Jazz Vipers at WBAI, New York City.
And that wasn't it. Well, it was a musical break, but it was also a station break. And this is WBAI, and not only on 99.5 on the FM dial, but also on the web at WBAI.org, where we stream live and archive things, too. So check it out. And my name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. And just a few words before we get to the next segment. The U.S. economy seems to be slowing. We're likely to get a weak employment report tomorrow morning with less than 100,000 new jobs created in the month of December, if that. Retail sales in the month of December were okay but disappointing, and new claims for unemployment insurance are drifting higher. The consensus on Wall Street is that this may be temporary, that the economy will take off again later this year. A couple of days ago, the Federal Reserve released the minutes of their last policymaking meeting, and they also agreed that the slowdown was temporary, but they seem worried that inflationary pressures remain, which means that the unemployment rate is just too low for their comfort and wages might start rising. The late 1990s were about the only time in the last 30 years when average people got a piece of the economic action, and that was in large part because the unemployment rate stayed low for quite a while. If the economy does pick up steam again, the Fed looks likely to try to step on its fuel hose. And if it doesn't pick up steam again, the unemployment rate will probably drift higher. So either way, it looks like the working class has gotten about as much as it will out of this economic expansion, and that hasn't been very much. Barney Frank, the new chair of the House Financial Services Committee, gave an interesting speech yesterday in which he made some of those points that I just made, that the general well-being of most people has become separated from the headline economic indicators. That's always been true to some degree, but it is more so than ever now. Frank also made some threatening noises about the Federal Reserve. He said, "I mean, we can debate whether Terry Schiavo's life should be recognized as over. We can debate abortion. We can debate the war in Iraq. We can debate the most fundamental questions in human existence, but God forbid anybody in elected office should talk about whether or not the Fed can, whether or not we need a 25 basis point increase in the Federal Reserve. That somehow that's sacrosanct. No, it isn't. It's public policy." End quote. Frank is a smart and witty guy, but we'll see what, if anything, comes of this. I'm not expecting much. And now, a little musical break, and we'll be back with Charlie Komenoff. And then, of course, The Who from many, many, many years ago, going mobile. And the tax man won't be missing you if our next guest has his way, Charles Komenoff, energy economist and proponent of carbon taxes. And this seems especially apt. The temperature now is 55 degrees, January 4th. It's going up to 70 this weekend. Something weird is going on. The UK Meteorological Office predicting that 2007 may well be the warmest in history. And we're sort of diddling around, but we need to do something serious if we don't want to have the water up around our ankles sometime in the next several years or decades. Charlie Komenoff is an energy economist who first came to prominence as a consultant against nuclear power in the 1970s and now devotes his professional and even, I guess, personal life to getting automobiles and other emitters of greenhouse gases under control. And Charlie is speaking tonight along with Don Rosenblum, and they will be appearing at a forum on carbon taxes tonight at the McRae Theater. That's the first floor, 220 East 15th Street, between 2nd and 3rd Avenues, and that starts at 7 p.m., so you have plenty of time to get there if you're nearby. Again, that's 220 East 15th Street, first floor, and I'll say that again at the end of the half hour. Welcome to Behind the News, Charlie.
Hi, Doug.
So carbon taxes, maybe a lot of people don't know what that is, so let's just start with some definitions.
It's actually a carbon dioxide tax or a carbon emissions tax, and the idea is that if we're going to do anything serious about the climate crisis that you just described, we've got to go to the heart. The climate, humanity is destabilizing the climate very dangerously, has been for a while, but now it's getting to some serious tipping points. And that's primarily because of emissions of carbon dioxide from the burning of fossil fuels. And it's economics 101, whether you took it in college or not, to reduce the use of something, you've got to have the price of that thing, that activity, burning fossil fuels and burning carbon-based fuels, which emits carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, you've got to have the price reflect the cost. And the only way to do that is to tax the hell out of carbon dioxide emissions.
Well, what is the mix? How much comes from the tailpipes of motor vehicles? How much from utility plants, factories? How does it all stack up?
There's U.S. and worldwide. Let's look at the U.S. because that's the thing that Americans supposedly would have some control over.
And we are the biggest global pig when it comes to carbon emissions.
Yes. And in fact, on a per capita, per person basis, Americans, the average American emits about 5.5 times as much carbon dioxide as the average of everybody else living in the planet, which includes Canadians, Indians, Chinese, Britons, French, Germans, et cetera. So,
to be fair, the Canadians are no slouches either, right?
Yeah, although they're actually a good deal, 20, 30, 40% per capita less than we are, surprisingly. So, the average American in a day and a quarter emits as much carbon dioxide as the average non-American does in a week. So, the American share of world emissions, the number one part of that is the burning of coal to make electricity. The number two piece is automobiles. Number three would be trucks. Number four is airplanes. And then you go down the list. And unfortunately, the list is hundreds of activities long. If there were just one or two things that we Americans and we humans do that cause carbon dioxide to go into the atmosphere, maybe we could use regulatory standards or efficiency standards to get those under control. But the sources of carbon are so myriad, they are so pervasive, so diverse, and so dynamic because of the nature of capitalism, which just throws out all these new ways of burning fossil fuels to make stuff that people either seem to want or are persuaded to want, that the only way to really get control over these carbon dioxide emissions is to tax carbon fuels.
Well, people hear this, of course, and they say, well, God, I can barely make ends meet as it is. Gas prices are high. They've come off their peaks of last year, but they're still high by recent standards, and now this elitist living in New York wants to tax me even more. What do you say to them?
I say that you're right, that these people are right, that Americans are taxed too heavily as it is. we only have to look at what the United States military is doing in Iraq and all through the Middle East and most of the world to get a sense, an awful sense of what we're doing in the world. But whether or not we stop that, and by God, we sure need to, what we're proposing at the new Carbon Tax Center is to tax shift carbon, that every dollar of revenue, every $1 billion of revenue that we would get from this tax on carbon emissions would be used to phase out existing taxes that are even more regressive than a carbon tax by itself would be.
So, Well,
at the federal level, we would take a page from Al Gore's playbook and ramp down and phase out the payroll tax, the Social Security tax component that terribly regressively taxes workers. And as carbon dioxide emissions through federal taxes on CO2 come in, the payroll tax would go down and eventually be phased out. Now, if New York State, which has a new governor who has proclaimed his commitment to doing something about the climate crisis, if New York State wants to get ahead of the federal government, and that sure would be a great idea, New York State has huge sales taxes that could be phased out, ramped down, and eliminated as state carbon tax revenues came in. Analysis has shown that the net effect would be to put more money in the pockets of middle-class people, working people, and poor people through this tax shift than we would take away with the carbon tax.
We should need to get into a term that economists use, elasticity. We just had an experience with gas prices went up a lot. It seems to me that demand didn't go down all that much. So elasticity is the economist term for how much demand will rise or fall when the price rises or falls. So what do we know about the demand for gasoline and other fuels? How price sensitive is it?
Not as price sensitive as I would like, you know, to be honest. And it was a little sobering to see gas prices rise by about 50% over the past 3 years. That's the inflation adjusted increase in the average price of gasoline in the year that just ended compared to 2003. And to see demand not go down very much. And in fact, demand for gasoline in 06 was higher than it was in 03. But the point is, that gasoline demand didn't go up nearly as fast as the economy expanded. The U.S. economy, with all the junk that it includes, as well as the stuff that people really need, was about 11% bigger in 2006 than it was in 2003. But gasoline use was only 3 to 4% more. So there was, in effect, a belt tightening, a conservation and efficiency, whatever you want to call it, of gasoline use in 06 as compared to 03 of about 7 or 8 percentage points, the demand that didn't materialize because the price was higher. And so when you crunch the numbers, you come up with a short-term price elasticity that's about maybe 15%, a longer-term elasticity that might be several times as much, might be about 40% because over a long period of time, people do have a chance to buy a more fuel-efficient car.
That means if the price went up 100%, demand would go down by 40%?
Not quite, because these elasticities operate only within a narrow equilibrium.
Right. So if you know, maybe 10%, 4%.
Yeah. A 10% increase in the price of gas, all things equal, the economist's big qualifier, would result over the long haul in gasoline usage going down by 4% or being 4% less than it otherwise would have been given economic growth. But, Doug, the point you're getting at, and it's a really important point, is that carbon taxes can't be small to have the impact that we need. We are going to have to ramp them in and keep ramping them in year after year. I've got some sense of the trajectory that might do us some real good. But we're not talking about nibbling around the edges. We're talking about fundamental changes in the way we raise tax revenues in this country and fundamental ways changes in the way that we look at fossil fuels and the way we use energy.
Yeah, I remember when Bill Clinton was first in office, there was talk of a 50-cent a gallon gas tax, and the flamethrowers came out, and that one got put away.
Actually, but, you know, that was in 1980. That was John Anderson's very interesting idea that went nowhere of a 50-cent a gallon increase in the gasoline tax, and you could cut the payroll tax component of Social Security by 50%. It went nowhere. I'd like to think that the onrushing climate crisis is finally provocation that's needed to change the political equation.
Well, now if we see, look, in Europe, Western Europe, where gasoline prices are maybe $5, $6 a gallon,
yep.
Here we had that, you know, they peaked at around 3 last year. They're now down around 2 or a bit over. So gas prices, 2 to 3 times higher in Western Europe. Are there obvious differences in behavior? Do we drive more than they do or not?
Yeah, per capita, Western Europeans use half as much energy as Americans. They use half as much gasoline as we do. They drive a little bit more than half as much, and their cars are somewhat more efficient. So it adds up to using, you know, half as many gallons per person as we do. And arguably, they have a healthier, better life. They have more transportation choices. They are not forced to have a love affair with a car, whether they want to or not. They can take a plane, a train, ride a bike, walk. People do that well into retirement age. Among people in their 60s and 70s, walking and biking are just as common as they are among teenagers and people in their 20s. Now, I'm not saying that we're going to get to that overnight, but if we had – let me give you an example. What we're talking about at this new carbon tax center is an annual increase in fuel taxes that would be equivalent to 10 cents a gallon per 10 cents per gallon of gasoline, but it would be across the board for all petroleum products, natural gas, and coal, so that every year there would be this 10 cent a gallon increase. So 10 years from now, this carbon tax would be somewhat substantial. What you could expect to see a decade from now would be SUVs would be more or less out and sedans would be back in, because you'd have to be either incredibly rich or incredibly stupid to be pouring money down an SUV rat hole with a carbon tax. Coal power would be on its way out, and wind farms all across the Midwest would be in. Incandescent bulbs, sport utility light bulbs, if you will, would be a thing of the past, and compact fluorescent lights would be in. Costlier air travel and costlier highway travel would create a market pull to create a 300-mile-an-hour intercity rail system the way they have throughout Western Europe and Japan, and so on. So the transformations could be positive, in addition to which this could all be done in a revenue-neutral fashion that would redistribute tax revenues to poor and working people in a more equitable way than the deal they get now.
That is the voice of Charles Komenoff, the energy economist, who, again, will be speaking tonight on this topic at the McRae Theater, which is at 220 East 15th Street, across from the Friends Meeting House. That's between 2nd and 3rd Avenues in Manhattan. That's at 7 p.m. We do have a problem in the United States compared with Western Europe, our settlement patterns. We live in much more dispersed areas. I've seen some studies that World Bank economists have done comparing, say, the settlement patterns of Boston versus Atlanta. The fuel consumption in Atlanta is much higher because of the sprawl, the low density, and the lack of public transportation options. And if we look at the fastest growing areas of this country, they're the ones that are the ones that are least populated. When you think of a place like Arizona growing rapidly, there's not enough water. It's just an environmental crime that massive numbers of people are moving into Arizona and deserting more densely populated regions. But how practical is this, given the settlement patterns? Wouldn't this require a massive overhaul of the way Americans live?
Yes. But at least we would be ramping in the carbon taxes. So it's not as if we are proposing to hit people with massive changes. You know, you can't change the price of anything important, whether it's the price of money, you know, interest rates, or the price of fuel, the price of housing, overnight, and expect there to not be massive dislocation, which would make the proposal a political non-starter to begin with. You've got to ramp these things in and give people and institutions a chance to plan for a different kind of future. But there's no question that there will be pain in many parts of society. The advantage, and it takes some stoicism and some vision to keep your eye on this prize, is that the pain is going to be a lot less than the pain of continuing to go on the way that we are and wrecking the climate on which so much of not just the so-called environment, but on which human activity, prosperity, food supply, health, well-being, all depend.
Yeah, I was interested that the Stern report, the Nicholas Stern, the former mm-hmm. World Bank economist who did a report for the British government, came out a couple of months ago, made the point, which other people have made, but I think this really injected it more into the public discourse. The cost of doing nothing is very high. People act as if it's just the cost of changing our behavior, reducing carbon consumption. But in fact, the cost of doing nothing is actually quite high. And people don't like to talk about that part of it. But how do you accomplish the political task of selling something that's so deeply unpopular?
Oh, gee. I thought you were going to tell me and all our listeners that. I mean, that's what WBAI is here for, isn't it? No, but seriously, Dan Rosenblum, with whom I'm sharing the podium tonight at the McRae Theater, he and I are launching, and we have been developing our website. We hope to have it out there and let all of you know the link, the address for it in about a week or so, for a carbon tax center, which is intended, if you will, to let carbon tax advocates come out of the closet. In America, it's almost, I mean, I hope people won't take offense at this, but to advocate, to be an elected official and say that you're for carbon taxes is in some ways as perilous as it might have been a decade or two ago, or still is in some parts of our country, to say, you know, I'm gay, I'm bi, I'm different. It's a politically very perilous position to take. And what we want to do is make it politically possible for people to announce themselves as being for carbon tax shifting by letting Everybody know, and especially elected officials know, that they are not alone. If they come out in support, that they will be backed up, they will be supported, they will be applauded, and that we can provide the arguments and hopefully some of the grassroots firepower to make that possible.
What do you think of the relative merits of using price mechanisms like taxes to reduce energy consumption versus like administrative measures, like requiring minimum fuel efficiency on automobiles or requiring electric utilities to,
to reduce wind or solar?
How does it all stack up?
It's interesting. I've actually had a bit of a conversion about these CAFE standards, these corporate average fuel economy MPG standards for cars. I used to think that they were almost, you know, just no more than the icing on the cake, and that it was the price increases in the 80s and the late 70s that drove the improvements in car miles per gallon efficiency. And I think in retrospect that the CAFE standards did have a big impact. And these efficiency standards in refrigerators, they're important. Minimum portfolio standards for renewable energy as part of electric supply. It's all important, but they can't do the job alone. These regulatory standards are too easily gamed. They are diluted by the industries that end up being able to maneuver around them. They're very circuitous. They're hard for people to understand. They're kind of scattershot. They're one-dimensional. They don't allow for behavior change. And worst of all, they're static. Dynamic capitalism, which you know something about, tends to moot regulatory standards which are necessarily backward-looking. The great thing about taxing fuels is that it looks forward and enables industries, institutions, and even individuals to plan for a different kind of future.
And what's your opinion of emissions trading schemes? The European Union's got one of these going now, where companies can sell the right to pollute to other companies.
Well, you know, it's probably better than nothing, but it's a real second best. The equity problem is really serious. The good thing about carbon taxing is that you'll know ahead of time how much revenue you'll get, so you can design a revenue redistribution scheme that's going to protect vulnerable people, poor people especially, who need that kind of protection. In a cap-and-trade system, you don't know what the revenues are going to be. In fact, you may not even get revenues if the rights to pollute are given away instead of auctioned, which may be the system we're going to end up with given the way the politics are in this country. The price increases from cap-and-trade aren't as predictable as we need. It's only been done so far for electricity. We need all sectors to be involved. And more than anything, we need a transparent kind of system. And the thing about carbon taxes that some people consider a drawback, that they're kind of in your face, I think that that's the advantage. And I hope that the American people are ready for some plain truths about what we are walking into and driving into with climate change, and that they're ready to face a different kind of future. And carbon taxing is an honest way to help them and all of us do this together.
And bottom line, you're calling for, approximately a doubling in the cost of energy over the next decade or so?
Yeah, that's it. Ramped in.
And what about, market fluctuations in prices?
Well, if we have peak oil or more market manipulation and prices go up faster, then the taxes could be backed off a little bit. The important thing is for the prices to go up, but for the energy corporations to not skim off all this billions in revenue or trillions in economic rent that are just going to go to the owners, the share owners of the oil companies. This is revenue that needs to belong to the people, and it needs to either be tax shifted back to them or rebated back to them.
All right. Well, good luck with this campaign. I couldn't support it more enthusiastically than I do. Thank you, Charlie. And Charles Komenoff will be speaking tonight with Dan Rosenblum at the McRae Theater, which is at 220 East 15th Street in Manhattan, across from the Friends Meeting House. That's between 2nd and 3rd Avenues. 7 p.m. Goes till about 8:30, and plenty of time for Q&A. So get over there if you can. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. And let's go out with this old ditty from Sonic Youth back when they were sort of youthful.